We continue here our series, The Mysteries of Watergate, Episode 5, CIA Operations Under White House Cover.
I want to talk to you tonight from my heart on a subject of deep concern to every American.
Those who hate you don't win unless you hate them.
I've been charged with involvement in
a full, free, and absolute pardon unto Richard Nixon.
What has come to be known as the Watergate Affair.
I'm your narrator, John O'Connor, and the author of the recent book, Postgate, How the Washington Post Betrayed Deep Throat, Covered Up Watergate, and Began Today's Partisan Advocacy Journalism. Any history of the Watergate scandal includes some mention of the apparent irrationality of the Nixon campaign's risky burglary of an unattractive target, the DNC. When Nixon was cruising to a lopsided win over presumed Democratic National Committee nominee, South Dakota Senator George McGovern. But the same can be said of the CIA involvement in the Watergate burglaries. What would the CIA obtain of value from wiretapping the unexciting DNC? We've discussed in previous episodes the lack of motive for the White House to wiretap the DNC. But what about the CIA? Let us mention one long-time serious interest of the CIA, sex, a key part of its, quote, research, unquote, into manipulation of subjects of interest. For example, in the 1950s, the CIA set up an apartment on Telegraph Hill in San Francisco, complete with a two-way mirror for watching prostitutes and drugged subjects. Sexual activity was a key to psychological control, a weapon of extortion, and a means of getting information. All of this was revealed during the Church Committee hearings in 1975, looking into intelligence agency abuses. Sexual sites throughout the country over decades have been solidly confirmed. But more on sexual targets later. Hunt knew he was hired by the White House in part to find ways to discredit Daniel Ellsberg. He and Mullen President Robert Bennett then helpfully suggested that the CIA medical staff could do a psychological profile on Ellsberg, to which the plumbers happily agreed. We would mention here that the White House plumbers were extreme naïfs, David Young and Eagle Crow, true Boy Scouts. A third plumber at the time was the unguided missile Gordon Liddy, later to go to the CRP. The CIA produced two intentionally bland and meaningless reports on Ellsberg's psychology, to the dismay of the plumbers. Then Hunt and Bennett suggested to Crow and Young that the CIA psychiatrist needed to have Ellsberg's psychiatric records so the CIA medical staff could do a thorough psychiatric portrait of him, presumably to be used in discrediting Ellsberg. Even if we assume a devastating future psychological profile of Ellsberg, how was that to be given wide circulation among the general public? It is not clear that any of the White House operatives were thinking along these practical, prudent lines. But the White House was not rational, and the appetite for getting dirt on Ellsberg was insatiable. Only naïfs would do so, as Crow and Young prepared a memorandum to be initialed by Ehrlichman seeking approval to obtain Ellsberg's psychiatric records. It wished to document White House approval for a CIA operation, but it clearly was not in the best interest of the White House if, in fact, the White House thought this was an illegal operation. At least Crow and Young knew that getting these psychiatric records would require an illegal break-in of the psychiatrist's office. Ehrlichman, somewhat plausibly, later testified that while he insisted that the operation not be traceable to the White House, he did not think that illegal means would be used. Moreover, Ehrlichman, with some justification, later claimed as well that this was a national security operation. But again, the naivete of the White House, including Ehrlichman, is shown by this amateurish documentation of its arguable crime, all national security protests notwithstanding. Ehrlichman could easily have prepared a national security finding signed by the president, in which it was determined that Ellsberg might be a foreign agent, therefore necessitating obtaining his psychiatric records. Such may have plausibly promised revelations by Ellsberg to the psychiatrist of matters of interest to the national security of the United States, such as admissions of Russian contacts. But these eager Boy Scouts and the non-naive but crazed Liddy did not see the necessity of so doing, nor did Ehrlichman. Later, Hunt and Liddy cased the office of Fielding and took a picture of Liddy in Fielding's parking lot, near a sign clearly denominating that it was Fielding's spot. We raise a question here. If this, in fact, was a criminal action, which at least Crow and Young thought it might be, why would this picture be taken? Isn't this evidence of a crime? But for the CIA, the picture was not evidence of a crime, but of presidential approval, since Liddy was a White House agent. Likewise, you will see throughout Watergate the fine hand of the CIA in documenting White House authorization for its other domestic operations, documents that might incriminate the White House, but which would save the CIA should these operations later be discovered. It is noteworthy that the photograph of Liddy in the parking lot was taken. If the CIA was not involved in the Ellsberg/Fielding burglary, why would the CIA even receive and retain, as it did, a picture of this casing operation? More impressively, the team carried out the operation, entered Fielding's office, and claimed no success in finding Ellsberg's records. That night, however, champagne was on ice, the corks were popped, and the group appeared to celebrate. The burglary team, however, had told Hunt and Liddy that they had not been able to locate Ellsberg's psychiatric file, which would have meant that the break-in was a complete failure. Fielding later said that Ellsberg's file had noticeably been fingered through. Also later, burglar Philippe DiDiego stated that he helped copy Ellsberg's file. So from this, we can deduce that the CIA in fact obtained the Ellsberg psychiatric file, but that it withheld from the White House the fruits of the operation. The CIA, in short, was pursuing through Hunt its secret agenda hidden from the White House. This is an example of the CIA not only using White House authorization to perform domestic operations, otherwise illegal, but also of the CIA's penchant for sequestering the fruits for itself and not allowing the White House to have those same fruits. We refer you in this regard to the stellar research of author Jim Hogan, who details this practice in Secret Agenda, a book published in 1984. We note that this is a template for the Watergate burglary, in which phone calls were overheard but not recorded, so that the CIA could curate what went to the White House. Clearly, Liddy had been kept in the dark about the nature of the Fielding burglary, but all others involved on the team were CIA assets, as in Watergate. Liddy was important not only because he provided financial support, but he also was an unmistakable marker of White House approval. This would hold true in Watergate. Thus, the CIA would want Liddy's photo in Fielding's parking lot, just as it would want his payments for bugging devices in Watergate. Liddy's involvement, in short, was CIA's proof of White House authorization of its operations. Before we leave this subject, let's briefly talk about two other operations in which the White House naively approved activity for its ostensible benefit, but what might have been, and seemed to have been, a CIA operation in which the White House did not receive any expected fruits. Hunt was sent by the White House, at his suggestion, to interview one Clifton DeMott, who was said to have potential information on the Kennedy-Chappaquiddick death of Mary Jo Kopechne. Hunt reported back that DeMott had no information of any value. Hunt also interviewed Lucien Conine, a former CIA operative with suspected knowledge of the assassination of President Diem of South Vietnam. Hunt interviewed Conine in Ehrlichman's office with the expressed intent of using a recording device hidden in the couch. According to Hunt, the recorder was not appropriately activated, so he and Conine had a long, booze-drenched conversation which Hunt claimed not to remember. So again, the White House received no fruits. So much for the CIA's help to the White House. Did Hunt obtain from Conine information valuable to the CIA? It was likely so. Certainly, though, as in the Fielding burglary, the White House got none. To follow up on this theme, we can draw a reasonable inference from the evidence that the CIA had its own interest in obtaining authorization to wiretap the phone of a minor official during the Watergate break-in, while giving certain campaign operatives, at least Liddy, the false hope of obtaining information on DNC Director Larry O'Brien. We do not imply by this that all White House personnel thought that Larry O'Brien was to be tapped, but only that this was the justification offered to those who knew of the wiretapping but might not have known of any hidden agenda. This, in other words, was the cover story should somebody want to know what this operation was about within the White House. Now let's go to the immediate aftermath of the Watergate burglaries. Howard Hunt, after the Watergate arrests of the five burglars under his supervision, visited both the White House and Mullen offices across the street from the White House. But for whatever reason, he left his White House safe as it was, with no effort to clean it out, or even to remove key materials such as his operational diaries. CIA operators customarily keep diaries of their actions, including appropriate authorizations. There were many oddities, screw-ups, accidents of fate in Watergate, and numerous dishonesties, as well as much bad judgment, all of which conspired to keep the real story of Watergate hidden. One of these was the decision of Hunt to keep his distinctive cloth-bound Hermes notebooks in his White House safe and not take them with him when he departed the White House on the morning of June 17, 1972. This failure was literally a history-making omission, because if he had simply retrieved his notebooks and presented them in the public record, the history of this country would have taken a noticeably different turn. The public would have eventually seen that Watergate was at least in part a CIA operation undisclosed to the White House, and the White House would have been seen as much a victim as a victimizer. But that morning, Hunt elected, for some reason, to keep his notebooks in his White House safe. Perhaps, we speculate, to lend a White House imprimatur to the notebooks. One of the notebooks contained a list of names and addresses, important but not crucial. The other notebook, however, was his diary, which CIA agents are required to keep during operations. The very notion that he kept such a diary is evidence that Hunt was working as a CIA agent while performing tasks for the White House. Hunt later claimed that he had noted the authorization for the burglaries in his notebooks, and for that reason sought the return of them from the prosecutor in his pretrial discovery motion. Before we go further, let's stop right there. What is the significance of Hunt's keeping an operational notebook? If a CIA-trained operative keeps an operational diary, the very nature of following that practice means that he is on a CIA operation. If he regularly keeps one while on a posting, he is a CIA undercover agent at that posting. So when Hunt later claimed that he kept an operational notebook for his work at the White House, this essentially is game, set, and match for the notion that Hunt was a CIA undercover operative while working at the White House beginning in July of 1971. Now let's go to Hunt's situation as it existed in the fall of 1972, several months after the burglary arrests. Indictments were issued for the Watergate burglary on September 15, 1972, naming the five burglars arrested at the site plus two supervisors, Hunt and Liddy. On October 11, 1972, following the indictment, Hunt, through his lawyers, made a discovery motion that the government prosecutors produce his cloth-bound Hermes notebooks and other contents of his White House safe. Why? By this time, the CIA had long before decided to disavow any participation in the Watergate burglary. It would naturally be in the interest of the CIA to have Hunt take one for the team and spend a couple years in a country club prison without pointing to the CIA as being involved. But that would not be in Hunt's best interest. He previously had hopes of taking over the lucrative CIA contract of Mullen, but that contract was now being terminated by the CIA because there had been too much Watergate publicity. So that promising possibility was now gone, and he no longer needed the goodwill of the CIA. He had a very warm family life with the love of his life and spouse of 23 years, Dorothy. She was likely as well a CIA agent, terminated in the wake of the scandal from her undercover job at the Spanish embassy. So she likely was no longer beholden to the CIA. Hunt knew that if he pleaded guilty, Judge John Sirica, known as Maximum John, would figuratively hang him from the rafters. Sirica had taken on Watergate as his pet project, for which he was receiving glowing kudos in the press. Sirica was threatening stiff sentences in order to force identification of the sponsors of the burglaries, which he implied likely resided in the White House. Hunt had no realistic hopes of pleading guilty and achieving a life sentence without spilling his guts about the higher-ups ultimately responsible. But turning prosecution witness would mean that the White House would not pay his mounting legal bills. So Hunt decided that he would be best served by looking for an acquittal through a defense which became known as the CIA defense. That is, Watergate was a legitimate national security CIA mission. He wanted to retrieve his diary, which would document White House authorization had been given for the burglaries, seemingly by John Dean and by hearsay through John Mitchell. Therefore, the CIA had considered this a valid national security mission, the status of which, in turn, he was reporting to the agency as documented by his notebooks. We note in this regard that Hunt had played regular tennis matches with Thomas Karamessines, his suspected CIA handler and a very high official with the CIA. Did his notebook show that he had discussed these operations with Karamessinis, thereby cementing the notion that this was a CIA operation? In other words, would it have shown CIA approval? Very likely it would have. And if so, Hunt at least would thereby have a good faith belief in the lawfulness of his actions, a valid defense which negates criminal intent. Moreover, Hunt's notebooks would have shown that for several other missions, such as the Fielding burglary, he had operated as a CIA agent undercover for national security purposes as authorized, he would claim, by the White House and approved by the CIA for its own purposes. But when he reviewed the government production to his discovery requests, the notebooks, oddly, were not included. Hunt knew that these notebooks would be central to his defense because they showed he was keeping records as required for CIA missions, and as well as showed the agency making decisions and keeping abreast of status. John Dean had cleaned out Hunt's safe, giving most of the contents to the regularly assigned FBI agents seeking them. Some sensitive files, such as Hunt's manufactured cables about Diem's assassination, intended to implicate the Kennedy administration falsely, Dean had given to Patrick Gray, the interim FBI director, for his future disposal. Dean, however, kept the Hermes notebooks, and only the Hermes notebooks, for himself. Likely, we infer, the notebooks incriminated Dean. There has been no suggestion that anybody at the FBI or White House had read Hunt's Hermes notebooks other than Dean himself after sequestering them. When Hunt's lawyers inquired as to the whereabouts of the missing notebooks, baffled prosecutors had no answer. They then asked Dean if he had seen Hunt's notebooks. Dean told the prosecutors disingenuously, "I don't even know what an Hermes notebook is." He then whispered to the prosecutors about his delivery of sensitive files to Gray, which served to warn them off of any further inquiry of Dean. It's likely that Dean had frightened them into thinking Gray had kept the notebooks and was hiding them, quite sensitive information. So from Hunt's perspective, a very cogent piece of corroborative evidence for the CIA defense was now missing. His ability to make his case that this was a CIA operation was taking water. Even though Hunt had infiltrated the White House to document, however tendentiously, White House authorization for various CIA projects, once the highly publicized Watergate arrests occurred, the CIA wisely determined that it would be bureaucratically suicidal to emerge from the shadows to claim this burglary as its own. So the CIA would not be offering him assistance in this defense, to be sure, and indeed, quite the contrary. Let's assume there had been no arrests. In 10 years after the Watergate burglary, a congressional committee had discovered that the CIA had been monitoring prostitution. In that eventuality, the CIA would have been able to show White House authorization for the wiretapping, thereby rendering, at least arguably, this entire operation legal in the haze of time's passage. But in the summer of 1972, perhaps this was a not ideal timing for that claim. After the burglars were arrested and Hunt was being labeled by the Washington Post as a White House operative, it made perfectly good sense for the CIA to deny any role in the burglary. Of course, what was good for the agency was not good for Hunt. Luckily, Hunt had his CIA agent wife, Dorothy, to testify for him. After all, as James McCord testified later, Dorothy was a courier for hush money payments. Certainly Dorothy, an undercover agent herself, could buttress her husband's claim that this was in fact an undercover CIA operation. Maybe as well, James McCord would testify that this was a CIA operation. A somewhat more doubtful prospect given McCord's tremendous loyalty to the agency. Hunt had Dorothy as a potential witness until December 8, 1972, just weeks before the January 1973 trial was to commence. Her United flight to Chicago crashed on that day, killing most aboard. If the CIA did not cause this crash, it was a very lucky beneficiary of it. Whether the crash was mere fortuity or was the result of CIA sabotage is not a question we can answer here. We can say, however, that within minutes of the crash, at least one CIA man and numerous FBI agents were sifting through the wreckage, somewhat unusual, almost as if the crash was anticipated. Was there some reason that the FBI had expected sabotage? Within 1 week of the crash, Colonel Alexander Butterfield of the White House staff, long rumored to be a defense intelligence plant, resigned to become administrator of the FAA, which had responsibilities to investigate this crash. Now Hunt had no witness on whom he could rely to corroborate his defense, and no longer had his Hermes notebook, strong documentary corroboration. There was only one other witness who could buttress his claim that this was an undercover operation, and that was James McCord. Interestingly, had Hunt retained his notebooks, Dorothy would not have been as important to the case as she became, and perhaps she would have lived longer. So the combination of no notebooks and no Dorothy was potentially devastating to his case. Hunt's only salvation would be McCord. 3 weeks later, after the crash, as the trial approached, on December 28, 1972, William Bittman, Hunt's lawyer, met with Gerald Alch, McCord's lawyer. Bittman inquired of Alch whether or not McCord would testify to the false retirement protocols of the CIA and testify that Watergate was an undercover CIA operation directed by falsely retired operatives. At least he wanted McCord to verify the false retirement protocol of the CIA, which would have been tremendously helpful to Hunt. On December 28, after meeting with Bittman, Alch met with his client McCord. He explored with McCord the CIA defense that Hunt had communicated to Bittman. McCord, however, was having none of it. Instead, he roundly denounced the defense as a White House effort to pin this falsely on the CIA. This reaction, ironically, was in a perverse way consistent with Hunt's defense, showing an active CIA undercover agent defending his employer. John Dean, thinking that a Hunt guilty plea would help him avoid his own exposure, urged Hunt to plead guilty. And Hunt, now bereft of any defense, did so. Judge Sirica made him plead guilty to all six counts. Let us stop once more to comment as we again force a Nixon team error, which would have devastating consequences. John Dean pushed hard for Hunt to cop a plea, thinking that this would be best for Dean as a potentially liable player. But by Hunt's pleading, as Dean, not a skilled lawyer, had not anticipated, Hunt was now subject to be called to testify before the grand jury because he no longer had, as a result of his plea, any Fifth Amendment rights. Once again, Dean's inexperience as a criminal lawyer bedeviled him, but in the end hurt Richard Nixon far more. Hunt has written that if the notebooks had surfaced, one of his principals would have been shown to be John Dean. In any case, now John Dean made an incalculable error. Hunt had pleaded guilty and would soon likely testify in front of a grand jury. So Dean was now vulnerable to Hunt's future testimony, likely not to occur until after his sentencing. But while Dean had blundered into exposing himself and other Nixon officials, he had also unwittingly done much to protect the CIA, as we will see in the upcoming trial. In yet another irony, had the CIA's participation been made dramatically public, as would have occurred had Hunt put on a CIA defense at trial, Nixon perhaps could have turned the tide and escaped his ultimate banishment by looming impeachment. Dean's client thus would have been benefited, but Dean would not have. The notebooks presumably would have shown Dean's direct involvement in and sponsorship of the burglaries, and his conviction would have been assured no matter what happened to Nixon. Indeed, Nixon would have his fall guy, Dean, and with a straight face could have claimed profound betrayal by both Dean, his trusted lawyer, and the CIA. But by unwittingly protecting the CIA, Dean had made Nixon more of an unprotected target and made his own testimony against the president eagerly sought by both the Senate Watergate Committee and the Watergate Special Prosecutor. So if Dean was a bad lawyer, he was a very skilled turncoat. Dean would become the star witness against his former client, the president, and go on to a glamorous career as an author, speaker, and television pundit. Nixon, on the other hand, would leave his theretofore successful presidency in disgrace and spend the rest of his life trying to rehabilitate his image. We have spoken in this and the past three episodes about the role of Mullen & Company as a CIA cover company and the CIA defense planned by Hunt. Finally, we have posited to you that Hunt had infiltrated the White House so that he and the agency could claim presidential authorization for his undercover CIA actions. But for such presidential approval to legitimize his actions, they would need to be for a national security purpose. We will discuss that perceived national security purpose in future episodes. There will be some advocates of the conventional view who will claim that this rendering of a CIA defense was all nonsense, the result of a spy's fever imagination. It would be their contention that pro-Nixon advocates have seized upon this imaginary defense, mitigating the ex-president's guilt as a last-ditch desperation pass play. So it is of great interest what Hunt himself had to say about this before the Senate Watergate Committee. He appeared on September 24, 1973, long after the dramatic televised hearings of May and June, which had featured star witnesses Dean, Magruder, Mitchell, and Ehrlichman. In his written opening statement, Hunt was careful to avoid saying outright that he considered himself to be working as a CIA contractor during the burglaries. At the same time, he pushed most of his CIA defense, that is, presidential authorization for a national security operation. Since no Nixon administration figure claimed a defense of national security for the burglaries, as Ehrlichman would do for the Fielding Ellsberg burglary, if there were such a national security purpose, it would be for that of the CIA, not of the White House or CRP. Hunt, in his statement under oath, admitted that his post-retirement employment with the CIA-connected entity, which he did not name, but we now know to be Mullen, and I quote, "After retirement from the CIA, I was employed by a firm whose officials maintained a relationship with the CIA. I engaged in essentially the same kind of work I had performed for the CIA." Now, this comes from Howard Hunt's testimony before the Senate Select Committee on September 24, 1973, at page 3663. We would note that after claiming that a Fielding burglary was a national security operation, Hunt noted the missing notebooks which had been left in his safe, which he claimed would show his defense to the Watergate burglaries. Now, let me quote here from his statement. "Some material was produced, but significant material was withheld or destroyed. Because the government had withheld evidence, I knew there was no chance of proving my defenses." Unquote. Then Hunt spoke of the effect of the destruction or withholding, which he currently blamed on the government, as hurting his defense of a presidentially authorized national security operation. And I quote, "This official misconduct deprived me of evidence which would have supported my position that my participation in the Watergate was an activity authorized within the power of the President of the United States. I thought it was an unwise operation, but I viewed it as lawful." And that comes from the same testimony on September 24, 1973, at page 3664. To be sure, Hunt in this testimony did not admit that the true national security purpose was sexual blackmail, but rather instead described it in his autobiography as searching for contributions by the Castro regime to the Democrats, a sellable purpose even though itself a cover story more favorable to the CIA than the truth. The Fidelista target would be a national security excuse, but it would be one of the White House, not the CIA. In fact, there was no evidence that the burglars were after so-called Fidelista donations to Democrats. But if in fact this was a national security operation, as Hunt thought it was, as did McCord in his testimony, what was its true purpose? We know that in the Fielding burglary, the true national security purpose was obtaining the Ellsberg psychiatric records, which the CIA thought might yield confidential admissions of him. But there has been no wide public exposure of the Watergate burglar's true target. In the next episode, we will examine the true target of the burglaries and solve yet another mystery of Watergate.
Thank you for listening. I have just completed a book on the same subject entitled The Mysteries of Watergate, What Really Happened. While it covers the material in our podcast, I have added two chapters of contextual materials and removed the repetition needed for a podcast. For those enjoying this series, it will serve as a valuable historical reference. For your non-listening friends, it will prove enlightening and entertaining. Thank you for your support.